Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. Those Palin emails, they came in a week ago. We didn't have time to talk about them very much on last week's show because we had just a couple hours to attempt to read them. But Kyle Hopkins in particular has had most of a week, and other members of the panel have been looking at them too. Kyle, let's start with you since that was part of your assignment.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I've been looking at them for a week. a few hours on Friday for sure, you know, like a lot of people were at the paper. And then certainly Friday night and Saturday morning, you know, my job on Friday, I had a couple hours in the morning and was just kind of randomly, I think like everyone was just kind of randomly searching keywords that you thought might.
Was this after the box came in?
Right. I mean, and almost immediately.
Boxes.
Right. The boxes came in. You know, I was up in Anchorage, and so the boxes had not arrived in Anchorage yet, and we hadn't started scanning those. And I think we were kind of surprised at how fast. You know, the first PDF I saw was a Huffington Post, and you know, maybe that wasn't the first one that was up, but we were kind of surprised at how fast people were getting those up, how fast the searchable ones were up. So I think I was looking at maybe like the New York Times searchable one, you know, before even our copies arrived in Anchorage. And, you know, I think I, like a lot of people, I think, you know, I wrote some blog items about, you know, you kind of keyed in. We did. You know, I keyed in, like I think a lot of people did, on Palin's sensitivity to criticism, you know, which I don't think was very. You know, it's not like that's not something that we didn't know, but you know, here it is in our own voice, and you know, I think a lot that was a big story, like those first few hours, but but maybe not the most fair story because it's you know, at that point no one had really looked at the whole volume of things. And then that night I just started at the end. My job was to kind of just start at the end and read everything. You know, kind of going back day, you know, day by day, and at that point, it's just kind of, I don't know about you guys, but it's just kind of mind numbing at that point because there's just this, I mean, it's a slew of stuff, and it's not just what Palin is saying to people. It's, you know, it's all these constituent letters to her and stuff, everything from death threats to like, can you come run in our 5K in Texas or whatever. You know, I would say that what struck me or kind of what I was left with was just a feeling of missed opportunity based on how much stuff was redacted. I mean, you know, personally, I just kind of maybe it's just human nature, but you look at those things and, for example, I'd be curious about what they thought about the Kinnickahn Bridge, right? What did Palin and her, you know, aides and confidants think about the Kinnickahn Bridge? And so you'd find the emails about that. And then, you know, within the, there'd be a little bit of discussion and then there'd be like this big swap the redacted stuff, and you can't help it, you know, just feel like, well, I wish I knew what that said.
Well, and we don't know, I'll jump in. We don't know how incidental or significant that redacted material is. Like, some of it may have just been kind of nonsense talk, but for some reason they felt that it was privileged. And some of it may go directly to the deliberations that took place and some of the decision-making that took place on major issues, which I think that, you know, the public wants to have a look at and wants to better understand. And we really have no way of knowing whether they made those redaction decisions fairly or whether they were overreaching in any way, unless we challenge it.
And the one thing I think we can be sure of, the Parnell administration, like other administrations, in this process, which has a long history here, it's not going to err on the side of the public's right to know. They're very careful.
It does not appear that that is the case.
Okay. Yeah. Steve, what do the emails tell us about Governor Parnell?
Well, I think you just summed it up right there when you just said that they're not going to err on the side of the public's right to know. I think when this first came about, and it's been this long lead up into the release of these emails, I think a lot of journalists felt, well, this is really going to, there's going to be some smoking guns in here. There's going to be some material that makes Sarah Palin look foolish or bad or something like that. And I'm sure that that's in the minds of many people. So far, I don't think there's a whole lot of that out there. Her sensitivity, as you pointed out, to being criticized, but that is a trait that we've known about for some time. So there really hasn't been anything that has made Sarah Palin look bad or foolish or whatever, or minimized her in any way. Yet the one person who may wind up getting dinged on this is Governor Palin, Governor Parnell. This hasn't been, I think, government's finest moment in terms of releasing material and making material that's part of the public record, making it public. There's all the redactions that we don't understand.
And if we might here, in fairness to our friends in the government, they're never going to be, they're rarely going to be as polished in these kind of things as they are when they come out on stage, fully briefed and fully prepared.
When it's something in their favor.
Yeah, you're going to get something the governor or lieutenant governor just reports, I don't know, I haven't thought about it. Well, that may be their state of mind at that moment, not their permanent view of something.
And I'd buy that. I think I can understand that. But instead, they've gone the other way in a lot of ways. They've done everything they can to throw a roadblock in front of the process here, and to slow it down, in my estimation.
I think that, Alaska media aren't the only ones to comment on this, that what we ended up with was inordinately tedious and cumbersome to get through and took an incredibly long length of time when technology does not, the technological advances make it easier. It did not have to be this difficult, and yet the state of Alaska chose to implement this process. And I think that there's a fundamental issue of management of and access to public records and the public's right to know, and it shouldn't feel or be like pulling teeth when you're making simple requests. Now, that having been said, I don't know that asking exhaustively for all of Governor Palin's emails is a simple request. And certainly we have seen that there have been some real challenges with that, with the state gaining access to everything they thought might be out there. So,
anybody want to add anything here?
And we don't have everything either. There's the redacted statements, but then there are how many emails that we still don't know, that we haven't seen just yet? They haven't been released for some reason. 2,200, I think, is the number?
And what we also don't have are any emails that were sent from a private email account to another private email account. The only ones that we have are those that were somehow intercepted by a user with a state government email account, or ones from private to private that were then forwarded on at the direction of the governor's administration to try to intercept some of those that were lost. But again, we don't know how many remain out there that were circulating among these private email chains that we don't have access to. And who knows what those reveal and what the tone of those emails were, and if there was a different level of decorum regarding state business taking place, and that what was, I'm sure, intended to be kind of a private communication flow.
Yeah. There's just no way that an everyday Alaskan, a non-member of the media, could access this material. There was just no way that an Andre McLeod. I mean, it was just going to be too cumbersome, too expensive. She's someone who keeps a close watch on government. But an everyday Alaskan, no way are they going to be, would they be able to search this public record on their own because of the fact that it has been made so cumbersome.
Okay, we need to move on. Steve McDonald, Mayor Dan Sullivan, held a closed-door meeting on the future of the Port of Anchorage, which is deeply troubled at the present time.
Yeah.
Once the doors were opened and the participants came out, what did we learn?
Well, it sounds like that they've reached a compromise to scale this thing back a little bit, just go with sort of a smaller phase that would give... be less expensive. I think the number is around about $300 million, I believe. It would allow for make room for four ships at a time, a couple of the tote containers, and then a couple of other larger ships. It would be the northern end of the port that would be developed. I think people who are in the room, some of the legislators, they felt that the number, the amount of money to build that phase of it anyways, was a little bit easier to swallow than what they had been told before, because it just seemed like this was just obviously a money pit and there was no end in sight. So I think folks are with the state now are a little bit more comfortable with the fact that they've decided to go with just one phase of this and at a lesser dollar figure.
Can those who are managing this project assure the public and the legislature that this is all we're going to need, and this is going to get the job done?
Whether it's all they're going to need, I don't know, but I think it's something that everybody can live with. The folks at the port seem to be saying that, okay, we've got our priorities now, and now we know where we're going to go, what direction we're going to go in. So I think they seem somewhat relieved as well.
Okay. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Kyle Hopkins, and Jill Burke. Kyle, musher Melanie Gould disappeared for a few days in south central Alaska and up towards central Alaska. It was a very unusual story. Tell us about it.
I think that's a story that began
and became prominent, I would say almost solely in the first couple of days because of that Facebook page that her friends and coworkers created, right? Because she was she didn't come to work for a couple of days, right? She clocked out at the Roadhouse, didn't come to work the next day, didn't come next work the next day. But apparently that's something she's done before. But her friends were particularly upset because she had left the dogs behind. But at that point, you know, this is maybe she'd been missing 3 or 4 days, and troopers at that point were not concerned. They said, look, she's not a missing person. We kind of know where she's
been.
That's
pretty standard, isn't it?
Right. I mean, it's...
You have to be missing a while to be a missing person.
Right. And they felt like they had some information that I think it turned out to be that she'd gotten gas or whatever, or been eating a cheeseburger somewhere like within the previous couple of days, and just were not on red alert at that point. But meantime, you have the Facebook page that's just blowing up. You know, thousands of people are joining the, you know, have you seen Melanie Gould Facebook page, and really kind of ramping up the pressure and kind of making the narrative that she's missing and she's in danger. And so I'm not sure how the decision was made among troopers, but you know, you went from, I think we were talking to them on Friday, and they're like, you know, really kind of tamping down whether this was a big deal. And then the next day, you know, a trooper in a helicopter was, you know, specifically searching for her, you know, saw the truck and then called off the search after what was what troopers called an enormous search involving, you know, dozens of people and ATVs and, you know, public aircraft, you know, the trooper helicopter and private aircraft and stuff, and then called off the search, and then you know, suddenly she's found, and then nobody wants to talk about it, right? You know,
and then it's presented as, well, it's her business.
It's troopers refused to say where she'd been, right? It sounds like it's a little unclear to me personally, like whether or not her, you know, the people who kept searching saw her first, or if she called troopers first. I think the volunteers saw her first in the Cantwell area, and then she contacted troopers. And at that point, you know, troopers just said, you know, it's her business. We're not going to tell you anything about where she's been.
Now, you've covered the police. Did they issue a report on this?
There will be reports. There'll be, you know, a search and rescue report. I think there'll be another report made from the troopers. But, you know, you can expect those to be heavily redacted in terms of where she was at.
Our old favorite. Jill, you've looked at the story. What do you think?
Well, I think just in our office, some interesting points have come up, and that is just the nature of what, you know, how do you determine when somebody's in danger and whether they're truly in peril, and particularly if you layer in a potential mental health issue. We don't know that that's the case here, but that's something that people have speculated about. And so Craig Medred, one of our writers, had contrasted the situation with Melanie Gould against the 18-year-old in Fairbanks who had climbed on the Chena River on an ice floe, who didn't really think that he was terribly in danger. He kind of knew the risks, and yet there was this all-out effort to rescue him. Firefighters, I think, went out in a boat, picked him up. He gets handcuffed, hauled to jail, and, you know, sentenced to, I think it was 10 days in jail or 50 hours of community service, which was a very different kind of response, like an immediate, you know, threat to life and safety, go get this guy and then hold him accountable, than what you see with the Melanie Gould situation. And certainly adults have a right to their privacy, and they have a right to make their own decisions in life about where they go, who they see, what they do, and who they report back to. But I think there's kind of, there's something a little off, and there's certainly a level of public accountability that needs to come into place when public resources are amassed to get involved in a situation.
I was just thinking that if somebody's missing here in Anchorage or even Talkeetna or on the road system, it's one thing. If the pilot is missing in an airplane and doesn't show up for a couple of days, that's something authorities are going to get. If you take off from Tanana and say you're going to be in Fairbanks for dinner, and then you're not there, it's going to be pretty soon they're going to start looking for you.
What struck me about the whole thing is that you had, I mean, people go missing in Alaska all the time, right? And people... There's lots of characters in Alaska, right? You know, and her friends did say, look, when she's had a hard time, she has kind of has taken off before, right? You know, the fact that the dogs were still at the house, that was kind of the trigger for the, you know, everyone being alarmed, right? But it just, you know, now that we've had a few days past it, I mean, what really struck me is that, like, I think if you wouldn't have had that Facebook page, you know, would we have paid as much of attention to it? I'd love to know how that played into, like, you know, how the troopers responded.
That had a role in how we responded as a news organization. But yeah, when the Facebook page went up, we're worried, we're concerned about it. then we started paying attention. On the other side, we also have gotten a lot, and I'm sure you guys have too in your newsrooms, where we've gotten a lot of response from Alaskans who have said, well, wait a minute, I want an explanation. How can she just go away and be the subject of the search and then be found and give no explanation? We want to know what happened.
Okay. An August trial date has been set for former Representative Pete Cott, who would be retried again on corruption charges, and Vic Coring, who's also been convicted but would be tried again because of irregularities in the first prosecution, gets an attorney. Jill, you've covered much of the corruption trial. We spent a lot of time in the courtrooms watching these events. Where are we?
We're at the kind of usual stage for the countdown before trial begins. So we're getting ready for pretrial motions. They're doing some jockeying about who the attorneys are going to be. In Pete Cott's case, how many attorneys will he get? His appeal attorney had requested two. She felt that the case was big enough and complex enough that it warranted two attorneys. The court disagreed. And her only solution to remedy that was to back herself off as the primary attorney, which the judge allowed to do, and allow a true trial attorney and not an appeal attorney to come in and take, I guess, kind of first chair on that. And the judge said yes. And so now the Federal Public Defender's Office will assign Cott an attorney. Beyond that, we'll start seeing some motions, I'm sure, about evidence and what should be included and what should not be included towards the end of the month. And trial in Cott begins August 8th unless they decide not to go to trial.
It was very interesting to me that the story I saw said the decision on whether there's a trial or not will be made in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that's probably at some of the higher levels of the Justice Department. We know that there are Justice Department attorneys who are listed as members of the case on this case. And, in our office, the consensus seems to be that it's more likely than not likely that they will not go to trial, that nobody wants the headache, that this is just going to be a mess for either side if it gets that far. So the question is, what do you do between now and then to prevent a trial? Does the Justice Department
cut a deal?
Do U.S. attorneys maybe let somebody, let Cott plead to one or two felonies and say time served and call it good and everybody goes on their way? Or are the defendants so ired at this point that they're up for a fight and really spunky? They're broke, and I would think with a taste of prison, you don't want to risk going back there. So I think we'll see some shifting here as
the
weeks count down.
Excuse me, I just was going to say that the government, they would be forced to put in a whole bunch of resources into this that they might
resources, and this is kind of like the final chapter in an episode that has been a huge PR nightmare for them.
And the government has lost, it would appear, its primary witness in this case, too. Do you call Bill Allen back to the stand?
Or can you make the case without Bill Allen? I mean, I'm sure that's something that they're looking at, and they may be able to do that. But there's a lot of moving factors, I'm sure, here that will affect decision making.
Yeah.
Steve, Vic Coring says he's broke. He was broke before he was convicted. He was broke when he was a legislator. He's got four bank accounts with $5 or something like that. Explain.
I'm convinced. He says he's broke. I'm convinced. I don't think Vic didn't get into being a legislator for the money. I'm pretty sure of it. He's the guy who lived in his office when he was in the House of Representatives. I think he is broke. I don't think there's any doubt about it. That he probably just getting out of prison too not long ago. He doesn't have work. So I think he's had counsel appointed for him, and it's probably the right call.
And I suspect in newsrooms around Alaska, people who've covered Vic Coring at this point are asking themselves, what would be the point of putting Vic back in jail?
Yeah.
Would it be more of a deterrent?
Yeah.
Would it be to correct him in some way? Seems to be pretty much the same guy.
He does. I just go back to that. That was the one way I can describe it is it was just a pitiful scene when you looked at that videotape from the FBI and the Baranov when he's meeting with Bill Allen the tape spoke for itself.
The Girl Scout uniform.
Yeah, it was just pretty bad. Yeah, it was pretty bad. I don't think Vic will change. But, if he gets out of this, and maybe it's for time served, maybe he wins, he's exonerated, I don't know what will happen here. But I wouldn't be surprised to see him run for office again. I wouldn't.
He'd have to be exonerated or get his civil rights restored.
Right. That's what's going to have to happen. It's a big step. It's a big if. But if that happens, I wouldn't be surprised to see him go at it again.
Jill, Governor Parnell, Sean Parnell, takes a rural road trip. Where is he going? What is he hearing?
Hopefully he is back. He was traveling at the front end of the week to the kind of the tip of the Kenai Peninsula outside of Homer at three small communities there, Port Graham, Nanuellex, Seldovia. When we asked about the agenda of the trip, his office said, really, there's no agenda. It's just to put the governor face-to-face in front of these small communities, hear their needs, hear the needs of rural Alaska and the Alaska that exists off the road system. Some of those communities that were preparing to see the governor said, you know, they were thrilled that a governor was actually coming to their community, to their town, and they have a lot of issues. Nanuellic in particular, still really struggling with how to balance life as a strong subsistence-based community with life in a cash Western economy and not really having enough jobs to make that work. So how do you do that when you're them? And they had some ideas for alternative energy and maybe some fish processing. They wanted to kind of float those by the governor and let the governor know how the state of Alaska as an entity could maybe be instrumental in that. In Seldovia, which has more, a little more infrastructure is my impression than Nanuellic does, which is close by also, you know, they're looking at things like, hey, state of Alaska, we just got $1 million to redo our harbor. We need another million to make it happen. Is there any matching money? Federal funds are dwindling. That was for sewer and water, which is a federal mandate. They have to comply with new rules, but the money's drying up to make it to make that happen. And so they're just looking for solutions like anywhere else in Alaska, job creation, opportunity to stay and live where you want to stay and live, but make it financially
possible. And this
seems possible.
Like an Alaska classic. The governor arrives by airplane. They put him in the back of a pickup truck, or maybe he's lucky in the front.
I know.
Goes into some town, whatever the town is. They find the community building, and governor stands in front of the room and says, shoot.
Right, yes. And they, you know, some of these communities are connected by like four or five mile trails, and I don't know if he actually took the trail over, if they pedal jumped on the airplane, but it's definitely different than driving up to City Hall.
Yeah, in a Cadillac with an entourage.
Right.
Kyle, Wolf Country USA, what does that mean?
Wolf Country USA, not surprisingly, may have wolves in it. I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. You know, this has been on authorities' radar for a long time, this business, this roadside business, you know, outside of Palmer on the highway. This is a guy who's kind of battled with like fish and game before. And you know, he's had that business for like 25 years. He gives wolf tours, there's videos on YouTube. You know, when I talked to my dad last night after we'd filed the story, he's like, yeah, I took your kid, you know, there like a few weekends ago or whatever. So it's a seemingly popular tourist attraction, an active tourist attraction I think he's been trying to sell. But you know, based on the videos, it looks like a dog yard, but the dogs are in fact wolves or wolf hybrids, according to troopers, who haven't been able to prove it before, right? Because you can have a law, which Alaska does, that says you can't own a wolf unless you're like a zoo or something, right? And you certainly can't own a wolf hybrid, right? Because fish and game think those are even more problematic. They're not a dog, they're not a wolf, who knows what they're gonna do, right? But they couldn't prove it because there's no good DNA testing. You know, Rick Sinnott wrote for you guys about this recently, like a few months ago, about how like, but now there is a DNA test. You know, they can swab the wolf dog's mouth.
Send, if you're brave enough.
Send that. Well, apparently they
tranquilized.
The search warrant says that they were going to be tranquilized. They tranquilized like 40 of these wolf dogs or wolves, and then sent the samples. They're sending the samples down to UC Davis. In a few weeks, we'll get the results. But the guy, you know, the owner, Werner Schuster, said, yeah, you know what? It's going to say that they're part wolf or they're wolves. But he, you know, he has this argument about how well.
Did he explain how he obtained them?
No. I mean, he's had generation after generation after generation of these animals.
So he had Adam and Eve, and they reproduced.
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear, but I mean, some of the evidence that troopers are, you know, used to get the search warrant are YouTube videos of tourists kind of walking through this place, and, you know, he's talking about, yeah, these over here, they were in Into the Wild, the movie Into the Wild, and, you know, I sold her sister to someone in Japan, and, you know, so it's a little business for sure.
Steve, the Bonnie Craig murder trial is finally over, and there is a conviction. This story has gone on for a decade
years.
And a half.
Yeah. The chapter's closed. As far as the community is concerned, I think this is one of the you know, iconic crimes of Anchorage's history, is, I mean, if you want to call it that. But this is something that's sort of haunted Anchorage residents for 17 years in the back of their minds, I think. Kenneth Dion was found guilty on all counts, raping, murdering Bonnie Craig. I don't know if it brings closure to the family. I don't know. I can't even imagine how I would deal or cope with losing a child. But at least they've gotten justice from this, thanks to the family. You know, Karen Foster, the mom, and her sisters, her siblings in this. They kept her memory alive. They kept the investigation going.
In the court proceedings, there must have been an explanation of how they met. What was it?
You know, I never did hear how they met. That's a really good question, and I never did. How Bonnie Craig and Kenneth Dion would have met.
Mom said that the family had never heard of this guy.
Right.
And that was part of the argument. That was part of their defense to the defense's story, which was that these two were having this kind of sexual, consensual sexual relationship. I think the family just said, we never heard of this guy.
Right.
And we don't know how they would have met.
That's true. I don't know if that question ever really came
up. I want to hear from jurors. Yeah. Have you guys talked to jurors?
Not yet.
Because that was a pretty quick verdict.
It was less than a day.
Yeah. Well, the verdict's in for us. We're out of time. We won't be here on the next week, the 24th. We'll be back the first week in July for Anchor Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.